Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 130. Oh yeah, here we go. Wow, wow, wow. I picked this... Oh, there go the jams. I picked this royalty-free music bed because it sounds like a bad Prince knockoff band from 83, right? Like Jeremiah White dancing. Feet is where my dancing lives. Feet is where my dancing lives. Wow, wow, wow. Could have been a hit. Could have been a hit. And the chimes. All right, I'm going to shut up about this ridiculous song. I would like to tell you the Nerdist Podcast, of course, is coming to New York October 14th. We're going to be doing two shows at the Gramercy Theater at 7:30 and then again at 10:30. Also, we're going to be in Portland at the Aladdin Theater on October 22nd. And then we're going to be in Northampton, Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. in November. So get tickets for those at Nerdist.com. Also, the Nerdist Way book comes out soon, November 1st. You can pre-order that at NerdistWay.com. And The Talking Dead, The Walking Dead After Show, will be premiering October 16th, right after The Walking Dead. A perfect time to have a wrap-up show for The Walking Dead, I say. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by GoToMyPC. Alright, yes, the iPad is great, but functionality can't replace your office computer unless you have the GoToMyPC app for the iPad. So GoToMyPC is the missing link to convert your iPad into your computer. You can access your entire home or office PC right from your iPad. GoToMyPC for iPad gives you the best of both worlds. You get more freedom, you get more power, it sets up in minutes, there's no IT help required. And now you can use your iPad to access all of your documents and apps stored in your home office or computer anywhere you go. And you can try GoToMyPC for free on the iPad. Download the free GoToMyPC app in the App Store, then visit GoToMyPC.com and click the Try It Free button. Then enter the promo code Nerdist. Thanks, GoToMyPC! And now this episode. I listed it as Penn and Teller. It's actually Penn Jillette. But I thought it'd be funny because I don't know. We wouldn't have talked anyway. So I just said it was Penn and Teller. And it would have been the same show had Teller been there because he wouldn't have said anything. But it was a real honor to... I actually met him the day before when they both did Attack of the Show. And they're both amazing. I could have talked to Penn on this podcast for another 5 hours. But we didn't. Because we don't do five-hour-long podcasts. So I'm going to shut up now so you can listen to this episode. But it was a tremendous honor, certainly as one of my influences when I was growing up. The Nerdist Podcast number 130 with Penn Jillette.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, I guess it must be.
Yeah, the pivots, there's like a gasket right there.
Yeah.
I've never looked at it. I don't know.
That's a firing mechanism. there's a silencer.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
This is a Cold War era studio, so there are a lot of devices that can murder you. We've already started recording.
We can launch a Soyuz capsule from here, though.
Leica?
Are those guys getting down?
Which guys?
Soyuz? Yeah, they are. They haven't escaped. They can get out.
Have you all read the book Packing for Mars?
Did you read it?
Yes.
Boy, that makes you hate life, doesn't it?
It does. It does. You know, there's another book too that Michael Collins wrote. The guy who was in.
Yeah.
The guy
who just drove around the parking lot while the other guys went.
My personal favorite astronaut.
When they got the awards, you know, when they got the awards, right. I always thought it'd be great if Neil and Buzz went in and he just stayed in the parking lot.
You just circled.
But you know what I love about Collins is that he went away for training when they were getting the training in the LEM and all the training to go down on the LEM.
Yep.
They didn't have the rover, but they had the LEM, of course. When they went around to have their training on how they're doing all this, they took him off by himself. And what they were training him was to fly back alone.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Oh.
That was his, so what did you do today, Mike? Nothing.
You know, just talk
to me about stuff, you know. Yeah.
You guys just keep making chip shots over there. Yeah.
I'm just able to get my ass home if you can't.
I like
if you can't do that.
Michael Collins is such a he's my favorite astronaut. And he's just he's down to earth. Well, weirdly, astronauts down to earth.
Have you met him?
I've never met him personally, but
I think you could date him.
I would like to.
You probably could.
He lives in the Cape. He lives in Cape Cod. I could go back.
You know where he lives?
I do. Cape Cod in Florida.
Okay, we just crossed a line there.
That's right. It says it in the book. It says
Matt goes onto Google Maps and just stares at his house on Street View.
Street View. Oh, I wish the truck would go by more often to get a picture of him. Maybe he'll come out and get his paper and his boxers.
Matt's gonna you're gonna try to bond with him. You know, Michael, someone needs to drive for you.
What's his family? How big a family?
He's got three kids, and
they must be adult children.
Yeah, they're adult children. Obviously, he's 80
adult children of astronauts. Special support group,
special corps.
What do they do?
I don't know offhand.
He doesn't follow them.
I'm a collector of song poems.
Really?
You know what song poems are?
No
idea. Song poems. You can go to. There's a lot of websites, but I'm one of the big collectors, along with one of the guys in Devo and the guys in NMQ. Have you ever seen, and I'm sure this is all below all of you, but in cheesy magazines like National Enquirer and Midnight, there's ads in the back, could you be a songwriter? Now, these are less prevalent now than they were like in the 60s or 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But it says, can you be a songwriter? Send a sample of your poetry. And if you send a sample of the poetry to them, you will get a letter back that says, yes, you're just who we're looking for to be a songwriter. And we write music. So if you send us your poems, we will put it to music and record a demo and send it to Hollywood, and you can make money. And this will cost you $200.
There's a documentary on this, right?
Yes. Off the Charts, it's called. The documentary is good, but the actual stuff is deeper and richer and more important. So what you've got, these go back to Civil War days. But you say, Penn, Civil War days, there was no recording then.
Penn, there were no recordings in Civil War days.
Of course, Matt.
You made it your own, and that's what I liked.
But they would put it in books. It was publishing. It was vanity publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started writing sheet music that would have your lyrics on it and then that. And then with recording, it goes full bug nutty. And a guy by the name of Tommy Ardolino, who is the drummer for what was the best live band in the 70s, 80s, not just my opinion, actual fact, NRBQ. He was the drummer for NRBQ. He's a big record collector, you know, vinyl. And in the 70s and 80s, he would go to record stores and find these discs that would say America's Hot Songwriters. And what they would do is these guys would record these songs. Then they would press 10 or 20 of the records. And they would send the records to each one of the people who paid the $200 say, this is the record we're making of your song. We're sending this out to Hollywood. And then they would have occasionally records would come back, and they would end up in a record store bargain bin. So Tommy Ardolino started collecting them, and so did Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo, and so did I. And I have a collection of about 200 of these records. If you go someplace and just look up song poems, you can find them. And they are stunning because they are – most of them are about just God or Jesus.
Sure.
Totally uninteresting. And many of them are about –
Aleister Crowley.
Love, which have some reality to them. But some of them are about subjects that somebody cared about and nobody else did. Now, they send the poem to – cynical musicians. Now, the musicians would write these charts out and then bang out. Of course, now they're done by one person on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a little less interesting. They usually come with a video, too. But in the 70s and 80s, when it still cost money to press something, and when you still had live musicians, and there's a sweet spot where they would bring in a band, I mean, like 10 guys, and they would sight read, just read down a chart while these singers would sing these impossible lyrics.
Oh my God.
To these tunes they'd written. And they would write real charts. And, you know, you'd have like junky jazz musicians who would be in Boston, where a lot of this was done, or LA, who needed a gig, you know, $40 a day to, you know, to buy their, you know, to buy their junk.
Right.
So they would do this. So you sometimes have guys that you go, that guy's like as good a trumpet player.
So this
like
is a perfect ecosystem of sadness and on all.
Yeah.
Except what you get. There's some beauty, and there's some beauty that you know how you edit when you get an idea for something, you're starting to write something and your first idea is pure. And then as soon as you start writing it down, you start fixing it
mm-hmm.
and other people start fixing it. By the time you get to a song that's actually on the charts, you know, a Jay-Z song or something, he's gone over those lyrics a zillion times. And so is the producer and so is everyone else. And sometimes they hold on to the kernel and sometimes they lose it.
Mm-hmm.
But these have this kind of raw passion. And I remember the first time I heard about them was a dishwasher that I worked with, an older fellow. By older, I mean younger than me, but I was a child. he would talk to me about songs he'd written. He was an obese, bald man who was, you know, borderline mentally competent and had a job as a dishwasher, but he saved up his money. And to give you an idea, it was like $200, but there were payment plans over a year.
Oh my God.
And he would get his songs done. And I never heard his songs, but he's still in my heart. And I think about, you know, I have these, I guess I have about 150 albums. And they have this stuff on it. And this is all going to tie in. I'm going to follow the rules of conversation. Don't you worry. And there's one song that sticks in my heart that is called Footprints on the Moon. And if I may, I'd like to sing a little bit for
Please.
You. Footprints, 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 footprints on the moon. The moon would like Neil Buzz and Mike to come again real soon. Footprints, and Neil Buzz and Mike. The moon would like Neil. Now, there is the problem, of course, that that Mike never walked on the moon. But when he's with you, it'll feel that way.
He was just keeping the car running. Do you have, would you send us that? We can put it at the end of the podcast. Are we allowed to do that?
You can, I believe if you go to,
we can just find it?
A guy named Phil Milstein.
Okay.
If you do a search for Phil Milstein and Song Poems Archive,
okay.
you can find Footprints on the Moon. You can also find a song called Jimmy Carter Says Yes. now, Jimmy Carter, there's a lot of stuff about presidents. There's one that says, starts out, the lyrics are, God, in his infinite wisdom, put Richard Nixon on this earth.
Wow.
But also, in terms of unintended irony, Jimmy Carter Says Yes has the lyrics, can the government be competent? Jimmy Carter says yes. Jimmy Carter says yes. Can a government be decent and open? As the 34th president, he has spoken yes. Jimmy Carter says yes.
Wow. Now,
and then it has a burning trumpet solo. I mean, burning trumpet. Like the guy who's playing is a monster.
Oh, it's fantastic.
And it's this disco beat. And there's also a song called Disco Lady. That Disco Lady, I love your sexy moves. Disco Lady, I love your bouncing boobs. Disco Lady. And it goes on like that. And this stuff has...
I agree with that entire song.
I'm telling you, when you listen to this stuff, what goes away, you say sadness, but what goes away is cynicism. There's absolutely no cynicism. Even though the musicians don't care at all about the music, there's this purity that comes over. And I'm telling you, if you start listening to song poems, when you turn on the radio, when you turn on regular music, it'll sound so overprocessed. You know, it'll be like with song poems, you're eating like vegetables, and in regular songs you're eating like processed flour.
Now that's interesting. You bring up an interesting point and something that I'm constantly fascinated by, because
we weren't here to talk about song poems.
I want to talk about song poems. We can talk about whatever you want. I want to talk about what you want to talk about, but you bring up an interesting point, which is because you've been, I know, you started in the 70s, you know, you started in the 70s, so you've seen a few decades. And so what I want to know is, I always refer to the 80s as the pre-irony artistic era. Like, we didn't really get cynicism and irony in our creative endeavors until the 90s, I think, mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And now it's all irony, so...
Unless you ignore the ancient Greeks.
Unless no, I know. You I mean in American culture.
Jonathan Swift.
Yes, no, I know all that.
I beg to differ.
I mean in American
Steve
media.
Steve Allen. I think
Ernie Kovacs, I know.
There was irony invented before you little pissant.
I know, I am. But I mean in our contemporary media culture.
Yeah, pop culture.
David Letterman is the one who starts says nothing he means ever.
But you guys too.
Well, you know, that is not true. That is simply not true.
Really?
The word irony, thanks to Alanis Morissette.
Ruined it.
Has been, it now sometimes means sad, it sometimes means wrong, and it sometimes means smartass. But I have found in our career that for the most part, if you go through anything I'm saying, I am really speaking as honestly and directly from my heart as possible. And I try to say that in an interesting way. And that sometimes gets seen as irony or sarcasm. But my enemy in the world is cynicism. Mm-hmm. I think there's very few things more evil and more unpleasant than cynicism. And it's remarkable how with all this cult of, and it all gets mushed together,
sure.
Cynicism, sarcasm, irony, this whole cult of this, our whole culture of this, that you're not supposed to say what you mean, saying what you mean is really powerful.
Right.
You know, it's really powerful to do that. And if you look at our show, Bullshit, you know, very little of it is arch. Very little of it is with a wink.
Yeah.
Most of it ends up, if you take out the obscenity and you take out the nudity, it is almost to the point of cloyingly earnest. I mean, I would look at the scripts and go, can we really get away with ending the show again with be kind to each other, be honest, and love each other? Can we really do that again?
Yeah.
And, well, I guess we'll put in much more obscenity, and we'll bring someone in naked at the end, and no one will notice that what we're essentially saying is, shouldn't people tell the truth? Yeah. But, you know, the whole idea that our culture, and, you know, Bill Maher will proudly call himself a cynic. He will push for that. And it always makes me a little sad. And it is true that song poems start getting a little bit known. They're certainly not popular. They start getting a little bit known at the end of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the compilations come out. It plays very strongly into your point because it's something that the hipsters try to see as removed, but they get choked by it because if you try to listen to this, and I mean, you'll go to the website. You'll
absolutely
find it. And as you try to listen to this stuff, your first feeling is you have all the tools. You know how to make fun of this. You know how to laugh this off. You know how to make your comments that would be appropriate for your culture. And then you listen to like five of them and you, at least for me, you say to yourself, I like the person who wrote these lyrics more than I like myself.
Because they have a direct connection to something they care about.
Yeah.
And they're genuine about it.
Just the fact that somebody can love Richard Nixon, that simply it is easily laughable, but also has a beauty underneath it. And I have this, there's a great picture, you'll find it on the Song Poems website, of Jimmy Carter listening to Jimmy Carter Says Yes.
Oh, wow. That must have blown that fucking person's mind out of the water.
And you can't find these people.
No.
The people that wrote the song, there's several compilations, and just buy them, you know, it's $20, whatever. Several compilations, and most of the compilations are from my collection.
Yeah.
The people pulled the stuff out. And it says on the record, you know, if you wrote this song, get in touch with us and we'll pay you the royalties, you know, because you don't know who wrote it. And there's stuff by a guy named Gygax.
Different Gygax.
Gygax is the guy you're thinking of is the
D&D guy, Gary Gygax, yeah.
But as far as I know, not related
okay.
to him. This guy named Gygax who was in an institution who wrote stuff that even grammatically is insane and unable to be remembered. And the metaphors and the similes that are used are this heartfelt stuff that would never get by any editor. And I don't know, when you watch Plan 9 from Outer Space, mm-hmm. when you watch Ed Wood, there are some people that just watch it, this is the worst movie ever. And those people are fine. Great. Terrific. It's the worst movie ever. Who cares? I guess they never saw Manhattan by Woody Allen. But anyway, it's the worst movie ever. But then there's another way to watch Plan 9 from Outer Space, which is listening to that pre-edit dialogue. That first speech is exactly the way stuff comes out before you fix it for somebody else. You know, before you lay something out, it just has this kind of purity. And I find Plan 9 from Outer Space to have a kind of honesty that just often gets trampled with slickness. You know, it's not competently done. But if I have a choice of seeing a glimpse of someone's heart, even an untalented person, I take that over something that's just designed in order to sell, you know, that slick and that
good. Yeah, I was always fascinated by Brian Wilson's My Favorite Vegetable song. I'm like, wow, he really just loves those vegetables.
Well, Brian Wilson is a really good example of the two sides of that in one person. I mean, he is incredibly... talented orchestrator and tune writer, and then incredibly simple, and either from acid damage or it could be his father hitting him in the head, brain damage.
Sure.
We don't really know,
right.
But there is something that's not operating in all cylinders. So you get that, you get the very, it's exactly the right example to use, a very combination of very sophisticated, you know, if you listen to Good Vibrations, some of the most sophisticated pop music ever done at that time.
So incredible.
Coupled with lyrics, I love the colorful clothes she wears.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he's choosing. I love the color. He's got this beautiful melodic line.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the fake theremin playing. He's got this kind of orchestra of power behind
and
him.
Harmonies that are mind-blowing.
And then he's singing... I dig the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight sparkles in her hair. I mean, it's really, that is a 12-year-old girl.
Ooh, shiny.
Writing poetry.
Between them and the Free Design, who also just wrote about, who I could never figure out if they were the most sarcastic band in the world or the least sarcastic, but are you familiar with Free Design?
Yeah.
So, you know, like the song Kites Are Fun is literally just about how they think kites are fun.
And we really see that. I mean, if you're going to do your whole cultural bullshit thing here about irony, you have to bring in OK Go.
Yes.
Because OK Go, the mission statement of that band is no irony.
Mm-hmm.
And you can talk to Damien about this for hours, and he will tell you, we will not do anything we see as ironic, which is why that dance video and the treadmill video went so crazy is the idea of somebody doing a video of their song that isn't smirking. You know, it's constantly smirking. They just kind of do that. They just kind of stand there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a human beauty in that, that it's just great. And I think that, I like to think that we're moving away from that everything has to be smirked now.
Right.
And OK Go were really the pioneers of that.
They're great. They've been on the podcast, and they really do and also just watching the community of people that get behind them to help them make these.
Yeah.
These really – they're not just videos. They're like the art installations.
Well, what they've done is they've taken – I mean, they've taken the power away from the editors – and given it back to the performers.
Right.
What you do with MTV, and old MTV in the 80s, is you take – there's no performance whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
They come in. A stylist puts them in clothes. They jump around for 2 hours. Then an editor puts it together, like the reality shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one puts – you shoot people for a long
time. It's all post-production.
Then the editors put it all together. But they, with their one shot – well, there's exceptions, but pretty much their one shot – they – actually perform like a vaudeville group. Mm-hmm. They learn the song, they do the song in front of the audience, and it gives the power back to the artist. I mean, we got real excited about editing because editing got so cheap.
Yeah.
And now everybody can edit anything on their computer. And now, you know, everybody can do it. So now editing's a little less cool, and maybe we can start doing, I mean, one of the things we talked about when we were doing our discovery show, Penn and Teller Tell a Lie. When we started doing that, one of the things I wanted to do, even though it's just a science show with, you know, with jokes and, you know, the big gag of being able to tell what's fake, is we pushed really hard, can we do this live? And it was just this insane, why would you want to do this show live? What's important about it being live? And I said, just so people feel like we're there and talking to them and that segment three has something to do with segment one, mm-hmm. like we're in the room. Yeah. And can we do a single take on things and just move on? I don't want it to be cut all over the place. Can we just talk to people?
The magic gets lost too when people, because everyone just assumes like, well, everything's going to get cut up. And yeah. so when you can do things live, or if you actually hear a band perform live and they sound amazing, it's a whole other level of respect. It's like, oh, actually, they actually have skill that involves just sure. their art.
And they don't need another guy.
Yeah.
And also when people talk, I mean, just hearing people talk about stuff they feel in their heart is very, very compelling. You don't need, you know, to turn the whole shot around and do cuts all over the place. If you've actually got content, people really react to that. And I think that people that don't have anything to say insult their audience by going, we'll just keep things moving and they won't notice. You're not working for canaries. You're
right.
working for people.
Now, what do you think has happened with us culturally where, because I feel like, I mean, you know, on our show, I try to tend to be positive about things because I feel like, hey, not everything is bleak. There's good things in the world. You don't have to shit on everything all the time. And yet I feel like sometimes it's not taken as seriously because people tend to take, you know, people who are more negative seriously. Like, well, that guy's saying something real. I'm like, yeah. No, it's no more or less real than what I'm saying. He's just angry and negative, and I'm not.
Well, there's two things that have always been true throughout recorded history. One is the world is always getting better,
mm-hmm.
and two is people always think it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions to that, you know, during wartime where things will take a dip. But in the big picture, in 50-year chunks, there is less violence going on today in the world than at any other time in history. Even with Obama having five wars going on in our name, even with that appalling thing, even with people on death row in our country, even with the horrors that we're doing that are being done in our name that are inexcusable and unforgivable, overall the world is better. There are fewer people starving in the world today than there were 100 years ago. And I don't mean that percentage-wise. Fewer people. You know, because of the Green Revolution in the 60s, mostly Norman Borlaug, things really are getting better. So not only are you right from a kind of artistic moral point of view, but you're also right from a scientific point of view. I mean, yes, there are poor people in our country. There are people that are hungry in our country, but many fewer than there were 100 years ago. And we keep raising, and we should, I'm not saying this is wrong, we keep raising what we call poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we call poverty in the U.S. today, 300 years ago, would have been royalty.
Of course.
But I'm not saying that makes it okay.
Yeah.
I'm just saying we should keep in mind things are getting pretty
That's funny
good.
You say that. I was just walking by a shitty apartment building the other day, and I kind of in my head was shitting on it. Like, why would they build that piece of shit? And then I actually had the thought, it's still an achievement that we have buildings with indoor plumbing, and just the fact that we get so satisfied so quickly with like, well, this is the status quo, and in relation to other stuff, that thing's a piece of shit. But you're right, 200 years ago.
Louis C.K.
Amazing.
In his famous bit, covered all that so beautifully by the guy complaining about
on the plane.
Oh, the
yeah.
Wi-Fi on the plane. Yeah.
5 years ago, you couldn't even fucking...
Louis C.K. now owns that idea.
Yeah.
It was so important that idea was said. All I would say to you about your shitty apartment building is, could you build one?
No, absolutely not.
We're going to drop you right now in the middle of Montana.
Here's some wood.
I could build one. I can't promise you'd live in it.
It's just going to be a lean-to on itself.
Listen.
Yeah. But it'll look more like a fort. Yeah.
Rent's affordable, though. Come on, guys.
Yeah, come on.
A lot of that stuff is perspective. I remember like my first place that I got on my own was this shitty, dilapidated house underneath a freeway overpass where I had to take a shower in a separate little shack in the backyard.
Oh, cool.
And I remember just being like, it's like, this is pretty fucking awesome. I'm paying $150 and this is fucking it.
It's yours.
I fucking did it. And then like the next time I got it, it wasn't still.
What he means is he got blown in that apartment. That's all that story meant.
Yeah.
And it cost him only twice his rent for the
that
month.
Was it.
See?
And then he sent her outside to the shower shack.
Yeah.
And then sent her
They don't
away.
Care where they have to do it.
They don't
as
care.
As long as you give them the money.
Tin roof rusted.
Jonah's love shack.
Yeah. Holes in the floors.
What was Asparagus Valley Cultural Society?
Asparagus Valley Cultural Society was just Penn and Teller with a third person.
Okay.
When we first started out, we had a third member of the group who was a classical musician. And we did kind of what Teller and I do. Although the third member of our Asparagus Valley was a Lutheran.
Okay.
So the skeptical elements and the atheist elements of our show were not there.
Mm-hmm.
When we finally split up, which was very early on, we ended up having more of the skeptical elements in there. But it was a very similar show. We ran in San Francisco for 3 years. I was, you know, in my early 20s, and we did the show there. And it was a lot of fun. You know, it was nutty to have a show that I believe to be unbelievable, like your shack, unbelievably successful. You know, mm-hmm. I could not believe I was making money doing exactly what I wanted to do. You know, my dad was a jail guard, you know. So the idea that you could make money doing something that wasn't repulsive was still a brand new idea to me.
Did that fuck with your head a little bit?
Yeah, a lot. You know, to make, you know, my dad worked so hard to support his family. He later retired and became a numismatist,
mm-hmm.
coin dealer, and did much better.
It's the Nerdist podcast. We get that.
I had a coin collection.
But the idea that that you could, and many people are facing this, that you not only can earn a living, but you can also earn a living doing something that you find fulfilling and satisfying, which I don't think there are many people who would say that being a jail guard is anything but a job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I imagine there's somebody somewhere that looks forward to going to work as a jail guard, but I'm not sure I want to know that.
We had a jail guard who worked with us at the funeral home, and he desperately wanted to get to the funeral home.
Really?
Yep.
What did you do at the funeral home?
I was a funeral assistant, so I did pretty much everything.
So you dealt with the cadavers?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything.
I was in dietary at the hospital, which meant I was a dishwasher. It was called dietary aid when I was in high school. It was the only place that would hire me with long hair.
Yeah.
So I had to wear a hairnet. And we had to clean out all the pots and pans, sure. and clean out all the dishwashers. And we also had to go in and clean out the autopsy room.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And you would pull the sink drain,
yeah.
you know, and there would be giblets in there.
Yeah.
People giblets.
And you'd kind of, you know, knock it into the trash and then give it the wash with your pan dandy and put it back in. And the people giblets, that concept.
What's funny to me is like every time, if I happen to walk, if I'm in a hospital and I happen to walk by a morgue now. The smell.
You get so hard.
Well, I did, kind of. I miss the old days when I walk by a morgue.
Is that true?
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
Well, that's that, you know, that's that, that's your Madeleine. That's
yeah.
your
that's, yeah,
remembrance my, of things past.
My dad was a professional bowler, and so I grew up in a bowling center. And so when I smell like Lane oil, I get sleepy.
For real.
I get sleepy because it feels wow. very comforting
this
to me.
This is the greatest collection. Your dad was what?
My dad was one of the greatest professional bowlers in the history of bowling.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, he's in the Hall of Fames. He was the first to do a lot of stuff. Like he was amazing.
Was
first,
he on TV?
Oh yeah,
first athlete in a beer commercial. If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I was named after Chris Schenkel, who was the announcer and who was very close to my mom and my dad. And so I grew up on the Pro Bowlers Tour with like Dick Weber and Earl Anthony and my dad, whose name was Billy Hardwick. And like that was our
Wait
life.
Wait a minute, Billy Hardwick is like a name that even kind of trickled down into my mind. Is that
That's
possible?
My dad. Yeah. He was on TV in the 60s, like, he sort of ruled.
And when there was pressure, he could throw that big ball straight down the lane where he wanted it.
Yeah.
With TV cameras on him and shit.
Yeah.
He'd
yeah.
bowl, like, perfect strike every time.
He bowled back-to-back 300s in Japan in front of, like, the Emperor's nephew. There's all these really great...
The Emperor's
great-
nephew was there? Oh,
the
my
Emperor's
God.
Nephew. Who was wearing no clothes. That were amazing. but he, yeah, he was... he is.
And did he take his little son on tour?
Yeah, I was on...
Did you have siblings?
I didn't have siblings. He retired when I was fairly
only
young.
Only bowling child?
I was the only bowling child.
Just Chris and the ball.
That's right. Yeah. It's me and the ball.
Let's go.
But it's funny because my dad is sort of a modern bowling skeptic in this, and I ended up writing an article for Wired about it where he said, bowling's too easy now. Technology is hot, has made the sport.
Oh, that was me. I forgot that you have those. Okay. And I have these.
Oh, you hit the. Yeah. Technology's made the sport really simple. So I did some investigating and found out that, yes, the PBA actually conducted a survey, and they built a robot
and they that threw thousands and thousands of balls, and they discovered that that technology has made the sport really way too easy.
What technology? Just the lanes being even?
Well, the lanes. First of all, the lanes aren't wood anymore.
Oh,
the lanes
I'm so are, excited! We're talking about something I care about.
Yeah. Do you really?
Yes.
Okay.
What'd you think was going to happen?
I thought we were going to talk about like pushing the show and the book and shit.
No, we'll talk about that stuff.
No, I'm serious.
Okay. So the lanes are no longer made of wood. They're basically just a synthetic material with a laser image.
So pictures of wood.
So pictures of wood grain, because it's easier to maintain. Sure. The bowling balls, the cover stock, when my dad was bowling, they were just rubber balls. And the cover stock now it's this composite material that has bits of glass in it, mm-hmm. like this reactive resin.
Yeah.
And so what happens, the reason balls hook into the pocket so hard now is because the glass grabs the lane and whips the ball into the pocket and reacts off the pins. And so they had to set up these rules that said that the glass particles in the cover stock has to be a certain distance apart from one another so that the game isn't, you know, too, because the game used to be all about spares and now it's all strikes.
I do not like games. I do not like sports. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a whole sporting event all the way through.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't like games. And one of the reasons I don't like games and sports is that the goals are so arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
If you want those pins knocked down, walk down there and kick them down. You know, I love competition in the real world. We want to cure AIDS. Now, there's a goal.
That's a goal.
But, you know, within the game, I've always had trouble with that. But I love the fact that technology has – so people who bowl 300s now are nothing compared to your dad.
No, because they might be, but sure. But the odds are, you know, my dad's – I think when my dad was bowler of the year in 68, I think his high average was like 212. And now people are averaging 250, 260. And they can't really make spares because it's just all about strikes.
Don't they have a counterweight in them now? Like you can have a weight in the ball, like the core isn't necessarily.
Well, they always had some type of. You could counterweight stuff. There are ways to drill and drop weights into the ball. I mean, listen, I don't want to make this about bowling.
Well, we made it about bowling. I'm fine with that.
I just get excited about it because I never get to talk about it.
I have one bowling story.
What is it?
I have a friend who works with us. He works on our crew. We've been friends since we were. Children, you know, right out of high school. And we were working at Great Adventure Amusement Park in New Jersey. What's Big and Purple has lots of rides, Grape Adventure. And and I was a juggler, and he was a fencer, right?
Okay.
And if it rained, the characters out on the street couldn't go. So we would sometimes go bowling.
Nice.
And he took bowling very seriously, and I took bowling very not seriously. And he was, for the first time in his life, he's a real jockey guy, he was bowling a 300. He was bowling his probably the only perfect game of his life.
Mm-hmm.
It was right near the end of it. Now, I'm not sure. I may have morphed this story over the years for being his final frame. It may have been the penultimate or the antepenultimate. But it was toward the end of all strikes,
mm-hmm.
all X's on that thing. And he was bowling. Now, we were assholes.
I already see where this is going, and I already feel the pain.
But the pain gets more interesting in a way that you might not expect.
Oh, God.
He starts to bowl his, you know, ultimate, penultimate, or sure. anti-penultimate frame, and he is focused and concentrated. He's in the zone. He's going to get the one perfect game of his life.
This is amazing.
And as he brings the ball back and runs up, I go, "Hey!" And I yell.
You motherfucker.
Oh, gosh.
And it slides off and hits one pin.
Oh!
So it's not even a gutter ball. It's one pin.
Oh, my stomach.
And there are people who've been watching him because it's this perfect game. There's probably a huge crowd for bowling alley, which is what, 15 people?
Right. If that.
You know, an afternoon, rainy afternoon bowling, and they're all watching. And he is an athletic guy, and I'm a big guy. So they're ready for excitement. And he looks over at me, and I look at him, and we make eye contact. We're very good friends. And he walks over to me, and he stands in front of me. And as he walks over me and stands in front of me, I do something that everybody in the room thinks is odd, except for my friend. I put my hands behind my back, and I just hold my wrist behind my back. and I just stand there.
Mm-hmm.
And he reaches down, I'm wearing shorts at the time, and he grabs me by my balls. And he squeezes my balls and then takes his fist and hits me as hard as he can right in the solar plexus. He just goes, boom! And I go, with my hands behind my back, I go completely unconscious.
Oh, my God.
You know, because I've just been, had my balls grabbed and been punched right in the stomach. So I go completely unconscious, and I crumble in his hands as he holds my balls. And I go completely out. And I don't know how long I'm out. They told me I was out. Not long. 5 seconds, 6 seconds, 10 seconds. I'm crumbled on the floor. I get up. I go, ah. He goes, and we go back over, have a snack. And he has worked with me since the 70s. He is in my employ. He is on my crew. And we have never talked about it.
Wow,
we've never said a word about it. I've never said, I'm sorry. I never said, well, did you feel like we came out even? It was just this, it was just probably the definition of what it's like to love an asshole. You know, he knows he's an asshole. He's not going to fight me. He's not going to defend himself. I have to decide what I feel this moment was worth.
Was it worth it?
For me?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Now, come on. Now, you can't tell me that and you aren't, but I think anyone else would have to agree, that moment made your friendship stronger than if he had bowled the perfect game, which you wouldn't have given a shit about.
What's the idea of squeezing the balls punching in the stomach? That's like how black holes form.
That must have looked like a choreographed, your hands go behind your back, his hands come out, and you go down.
And Penn knew what was about to happen as he reached his hands behind his back.
I've never hit anyone in my life in anger. Mm-hmm. I'm a pacifist to the world. So there was no chance that there was going to be a fight.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that about me. So he knew that he would decide how much he was going to hurt me and that I had already done the damage I was going to do. That whatever he did, I mean, imagine that situation. Whatever you do to someone, there will be no retaliation. So the morality of this story is only on him. I mean, he could have punched me in the face and broken my nose.
Sure.
Right? He could have picked up a ball and thrown it into my head and come close to killing me. But his idea was, what did this feel like to me to see that ball?
Just you know what I mean? The physical manifestation of what he was feeling emotionally.
Yeah, yeah, I like the combo, too. I like the idea that he was like, he's walking up to you. He's like, just a punch in the stomach? No.
Better
just a tug on the balls? No.
But I really love both. I really love Penn's reaction where it's just, hey, all right, I see all the paperwork is in order. Like, he knew that there was going to be an emotional cost. There was going to be a cost. There was going to be a payment to be made.
All that.
Everything's been signed.
Willing to pay
fine,
for
we're now going to, I'll get whatever. And I didn't know what it was going to be. You know, I didn't know. I think if you'd asked me right then in that frozen moment, I would probably have said, I'm going to get punched in the face really hard.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm going to get punched in the face harder than I've ever been punched. And it ended up that wasn't his choice.
I got to respect that, because if you were truly an asshole, what would have happened is you would have done that and then run away.
Running away.
The fact is, you did it. You knew there was going to be, and you wanted there to be a balanced and fair trade.
But to not toot my own horn too much, he would have found me. There was no place
I was going to be able to.
I mean, we cut to 8 years later in Mongolia, where I'm living in a hut, and he walks in. I knew this day would come. I didn't wait for this day.
Old friend.
He's living in that apartment building I built in Montana.
Like fucking Ra's al Ghul.
All the farm animals run away, and my new bride goes over.
Birds start falling from the
sky. Takes the baby.
Daddy, who is that?
This is an American thing. You could not understand it. It has to do with bowling.
There's a record scratch, but no record player. So, I watched your Revision 3 show.
Uh-huh.
And you told this the chimp and the little person story as a reaction to it was because of Adam Savage. But I'm the one who told Adam Savage on this very podcast. And then that's why he reached out to you.
I was
so excited. I couldn't even tell you to hear the story from your mouth. about the relationship of chimpanzees and little
circus.
People.
I thought you were circus.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's what they said to me.
No, that's what they said to you. Yeah. I thought you were circus. Because you thought you knew.
But I didn't know that. It was an astonishing thing, and I've talked to people who are circus, but the strange thing is everyone in circus knows this, but primate people don't. I guess they don't have a lot of little people around.
Right.
So they don't notice. But
circus people have both.
Yeah, both. And it was, I thought of this story when I saw The Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they do the computer cartoon,
mm-hmm,
of the monkey, and I know it's a chimpanzee, I prefer the word monkey.
Yeah, yeah. They're very offended by when you're called a monkey.
Right, but they're monkeys. that thing. And the first time that I was there, and the I'll just tell very briefly what happened. I have parties at my house, and some of the parties are covered in the book, like when I had a very fat, naked Elvis urinating on people while singing Love Me Tender.
Was that the fat Elvis that performs at the Barbary Coast?
No.
Okay.
This is, this is a guy called Extreme Elvis.
Oh, Extreme Elvis.
You know Extreme
Elvis. I know Extreme Elvis. And it's like G.G. Allen and Elvis put together.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Performance artist, but he can't get booked anywhere. He gets arrested. So, you know, he can only play private parties. What asshole would have him at a private party?
That asshole.
And he came out and he was, you know, urinating on my guests while singing Love Me Tender. And then we had an atheist baptism. It was a beautiful. And remember, all of this, and this is all that makes it good, is all done stone cold sober.
Sure.
I've never had a drink of alcohol in my life, never any recreational drug. So when I have a wild party with a piss and Elvis, it's all sober people. But another party I had was going to be my girlfriend at the time really thought that chimps were very, very cute. So I had a friend who had a chimp. And I was going to have a chimp over and then a lot of friends over for kind of a swimming barbecue party. And my friend Arturo, who was a little person, not particularly small, but certainly under probably about 3.5 feet.
Mm-hmm. Wait, Arturo, what's his last name?
Figueroa. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've worked with that guy.
Okay.
Yeah, Solve the Mole Man.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Arturo, wonderful man.
Yeah, he's great. He's an awesome guy.
Originally Mexican. And well, he is. That's part of the story. So I'm going to have this party. I hadn't seen Arturo in a while. He comes to our show, and afterwards he says, I said, hey, Arturo, we're having a party at my house tomorrow. You want to come by? Oh, yeah, man, I love to, man. Great. Okay, good, he's coming by. And then after he leaves, my friend Michael Goudeau, who is my co-host on the radio show and also the writer on Penn and Teller Tell a Lie, Goudeau says, did you just invite a little person and a monkey to the same party? And I said, yeah. And he said, I thought you were circus, man. I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, didn't you work circus? I said, yeah. He goes, you can't put a little person anywhere near a chimpanzee. They rip them apart. It's a dominance thing. I said, oh, what do I do? He said, well, you call them. I said, call who? He said, call either the monkey or Arturo. You know, one of them can't come to the party. And I go, oh, I'll call Arturo. So I call Arturo. And I have one of the most uncomfortable conversations of my life because I go, hey, Arturo, hey, man, what's up? I'm talking about the party tomorrow. Oh, yeah, man, I'm looking forward to it, man. Can I bring, you know, my cousins in town? Can she come by with me? Yeah. One problem. We have some people coming through. Yeah, man, what's up? Well, there might be a problem. Hey, I got no problems with anybody, man. Talk to anybody. You know, most little people, you know, they're assholes. They can be fucking assholes. But I'm cool with everybody, man. I get along with everybody. Talk to anybody, man. I'm cool. I said, I know you're cool, Arturo, and I love you. We're bringing an animal trainer to this. Oh, great, man. You know, when I worked in the Ringling Show, man, I worked with elephants. I worked with cats, man. What does he work with? Not elephants and not cats. What does he work with, man? He has a chimpanzee. What the fuck is wrong with you, man? He will rip me apart. He will rip me apart. He will kill me. He will. I can't be around them. They will kill me. Yeah, I know. What are you saying, man? I'm saying we're going to have to be really careful when you come to the party.
And then act three of the sitcom, and we return from it.
So Goudeau is there, and Arturo is there, and the monkey has not arrived. And Michael Godot, who's a practical man, a science man, says to me, we are going to put a chimpanzee and a little person in close proximity. And he said, we don't really know what's going to happen, but it's not going to be good. We need to take kitchen knives. Jesus. And if it gets out of hand, you have to look me in the eye and tell me you are willing to stab a chimpanzee to death to save a human being.
Oh, my God.
He said, we're getting the five biggest guys. We're going to stand there, and we will be holding knives. And if we cannot subdue the chimpanzee in any other way, we will need to kill it. And I go, okay.
It's a party, isn't it?
And Arturo says, we're going to leave your pool open. I'm taking my phone and my wallet out of my pocket. Monkeys hate water more than they hate little people. So if something goes bad, I will run as fast as I can and jump in the pool and try to stop the monkey from coming in after.
Oh, my God.
I go, oh, okay.
Rather than just not come to the party.
Yeah.
It's a party at Pendulette's.
I know, Chris. I know.
Something had gone very wrong in our social structure. I don't know what it is. You know, it's kind of mass insanity. We had decided.
I feel like it might have been you.
Coming.
You went wrong.
Yeah. I think that's a truth I have to face. Yeah. You're thinking you call the animal trainer and say you can't come.
That's what I mean. Yeah. You know. I understand that you didn't.
But wait, Matt. Yeah. Chimp at a party.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty cool.
This is the chimp that changes his own diapers.
Seriously.
You can say to him, get me a Diet Coke, and he goes in and gets you a Diet Coke and not a Coke.
The only thing he can't do is not kill a little person.
No, never mind.
That's the only command he won't follow.
I have a lot of those similar traits.
Yeah.
Now, you have a problem here. We have a lot of problems.
Yeah, of course.
But one of the problems is that people don't seem to understand that certain things are innate. And I'm not going to get into any argument about sexism because I don't have an argument there. But the chimpanzee will also feel up women. Mm-hmm. They will try to finger women. Mm-hmm. And if a woman tells them what to do, they also react very negatively. The person that can tell them what to do is the biggest person in the room. To the chimpanzee, I am a silverback. And when I would say, stop that, he would stop immediately.
Wow.
If a woman said stop that, he would go.
Wow.
And they also, it's great. If you have a chance of being a chimp, take it. Because really attractive women at the party, the monkey would just reach down the shirt and just grab her tit.
They think it's adorable.
They all ain't that funny. I don't know. And if they grab the hand, try to stop him, then he gets mad. It's terrific. It's like a soccer team.
Wow.
And,
like a soccer team.
like a Princeton soccer team.
And so... We have Arturo, and the way my courtyard is set up, Arturo is there, and Arturo has got people around him, and we just kind of want the monkey to see Arturo, right? And we have knives in our hands, and it's like this kind of Lord of the Flies thing. We have taken a solemn oath that we will stab a chimp, and for someone who is as pacifistic as me, this is horrible, but to save a little person.
Ethical debates.
Ethical debates. Certainly, if you had, what's his name, from PETA and the Silver, what's his name? It doesn't matter.
I like the idea that there would be people at the party going, hey, those guys are taking the little person's side. I think we have to band together.
to murder
and then
this
all
chip.
Of a sudden, there's two factions at the party, two gangs.
It could happen almost.
We need to get knives, too.
So my girlfriend at the time, an attractive actor from L.A., is holding the chimp like it's her child. It's wearing a little diaper. She's kind of sweet talking the chimp. And the trainer is right there. And the trainer is bonded to the chimp. And my girlfriend is bonded and is holding. And it's cuddly and it's sweet and it's great. And now what happens here is that there's a dominance issue. That the reason the chimpanzee doesn't kill everybody, because they have more strength than someone my size, mm-hmm. even at 80 pounds, is because there's a dominance thing, and they're smaller and aren't going to be able to vibe and this kind of stuff. I'm talking about shit I don't really understand, but I mean, in a very broad strokes, that's what's happening. Of course, what's happening in those pods is really much more complicated, and as complicated as what happens in our social structures. But that having been said, he's afraid of us because we're big. And holding the monkey, she's standing there, and there's this tension in the room. And Arturo comes around the corner, okay? And he's never been in this kind of situation, because in circus they keep them separate. Right there, kind of comes around the corner, and that monkey does that, you know, Exorcist, Rise of the Planet of the Apes thing. And my girlfriend, who has her arms around the monkey ape and is supporting him, he just goes, whoo, and all her strength is nothing to him.
Wow.
And the trainer reaches, and he's just gone, and he's on the ground, and Arturo goes whipping around the corner into the house, slams the door, and now they're looking at each other through the glass.
Oh, God.
And it's going...
Well, what if it just grabbed his balls and punched his solar plexus?
It would have been fine.
It would have torn off the balls.
And so then we're all holding our knives and flop sweating, and it's over. And Arturo was safe. And Arturo just walks away from the window. And the monkey can't see him anymore. And the monkey goes, and jumps up into my girlfriend's arm. And he's all back to lovey-dovey. Let me tweak your nipples a little bit.
Wow. Holy crap.
And then for the rest of the party, we did this thing with our cell phones where when Arturo was in the band room, and the monkey wanted to go into the band room because we thought it'd be funny to get pictures of the monkey playing the drum. Banging on the bongos like a chimpanzee. You want that picture, don't you? And of course, I should say
that. Well, that ain't working.
No, that's the way they do it.
Yeah.
I also should add into this, and maybe a lot of people hate me for this, but also we gave the monkey a lot of cigarettes because there's nothing funnier than a smoking monkey.
Like like Krusty's monkey in The Simpsons.
Yeah. Mr. Teeny.
You see a smoking monkey, you laugh your ass off. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't smoke, but I smoke cigar for the monkey.
Yeah.
And I know it's bad.
For the monkey, I smoke a cigar.
Yeah, yeah.
It's bad for the monkey.
I never touched a drop of alcohol, but I gave a ton to the monkey.
Well, yeah. And believe me, if acid were an option, That would have been considered. So we want to bring the monkey in, and then you would take your cell phone, and you would call Godot and say, where's Arturo? And they would say, Arturo's in the band room. The guys have been playing some blues, and Arturo's playing a little harmonica. And I go, okay, can you wrap that up and get Arturo out by the pool? We want the monkey to play drums. Yeah. Hey, Arturo, we're all having a good time here, but now you've got to leave because we think the monkey would be more fun than the little
boy. Arturo is a buzzkill.
Did you have to say that Arturo was playing a little harmonica?
I didn't want to say that. I'm so glad you did.
He played a little harmonica. They picked up a little guitar.
So the whole rest of the five-hour day is just rotating. You know, a monkey wants to go outside. Arturo needs to come in.
Yeah.
Arturo wants to go to the barbecue, get himself a hamburger. Let's bring the monkey
in. It's like and one of those puzzles with the missing block.
Yeah. It's actually taking the boat across the river with the goat, the little person, the monkey. And then the...
Which one do you...
Yeah. Take that across, and the wives can't see each other. Exactly. Riddle. And then the other only interesting... Besides, and I kind of slid over this, and I want you all to realize how sexy it is. It is very sexy in public to have an animal who can do anything to other people. The idea, I mean, like right now, we were in mixed company and there were like 30 or 40 people around, and we had a monkey that could just hand job and feel up anybody. We would be having a better time.
Yeah, you know, right? I mean, there's no
That's
question.
All. It's just because they're reaching, you know, you got this, you know, friends, girlfriends there, you know, friend of mine, this woman I know that's really wicked smart, wicked powerful, wicked strong, just great, wonderful, great, terrific. She's out by my pool in a bikini and a monkey's feeling her up. I am harder than Chinese algebra. I mean, it's just boom, bang, boom, done. But then the monkey does this other thing, you know. You start thinking, he understands English, you can talk to him.
Yeah.
You say, get me a soda. You can say all this stuff. You can say, no, don't do this. But then he just does something that's just so cool that you wouldn't think of doing. I mean, even if you were friends with Johnny Knoxville, this wouldn't happen. Someone's putting on suntan lotion, and it's, you know, It's banana citrus suntan lotion. And the monkey goes over and just goes and drinks the whole thing. He just squirts suntan lotion into his mouth. And then the trainer is trying to rinse banana suntan lotion out of a chimp's mouth. Wow. And once again, it's a great party.
Wow.
But I'm glad that's the story.
A wonderful story.
Wow.
And I also love, and then just sort of building off that, something you said earlier, that you've never done any substances. No. I've been sober for 8 years, and I never did drugs, but I just drank a lot. And
That went with the bowling,
of course. Yeah,
I was going to say that's why I go bowling.
Yeah, but what I love is that it just hearing you tell these stories and talk about, you know, and just from knowing what I know about you, your decision to not touch substances is very consistent with what it seems like your mission statement in life, which is having real, true experiences.
If there had been alcohol involved, we could not have mixed the monkey with the little person.
No. Right.
It would have been too dangerous. But five big sober men with knives can do science.
Yep. But also it makes all of your experiences
vivid.
They're very vivid.
True.
They're very vivid.
It makes
they're
them
very true. The parties I've had, and since I have young children, the parties have changed because of course child services.
Of course.
But I filled up huge pools with cornstarch. And we all know, if you're going to do a nerd thing,
yeah,
everybody
sure.
knows about cornstarch.
That's awesome.
And we had naked wrestling in cornstarch with about 100 of my friends.
Wow.
And what I found is, you know, if you have friends that are porn stars, and I do, it's very hard to get them naked because they're used to being paid for that. But if you have friends that are like nuclear physicists, easy to get them. You know, a woman that's a rocket scientist will take off her clothes like that
mm-hmm.
because she doesn't have to monetize.
In other words,
the value.
It ain't rocket science.
Exactly. So everybody's wrestling in the cornstarch, which is really cool. And we're all outside and we're all naked. There's naked cornstarch wrestling. And there's also a lot of subtext because some people were enjoying the cornstarch wrestling even more than the wrestling. And but I decided
stay on tap.
As the feature event, it was going to be Arturo and I wrestling nude.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, a figure is popping in your head for how much you'd pay to see me wrestle a little person.
$78.
No, the number's higher than what I would have thought.
$78?
$150.
Whoa.
How much are you going to pay me to watch it?
Ow, don't you play that game. You know the truth. You know the truth. Don't play that. Oh, I don't want to see a guy naked.
I'd love to see a guy naked, but the cherry on the top is getting money for it. But $155, including Ticketmaster fees.
Okay, yeah. So we're about $400 here. We can just do like that.
Yep.
But this is all free for my friends. And I wrestled Arturo. We were having a great time because we acted like, although no one fell for it, we acted like it was just getting up in a grudge match.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went up there to say something to my friends, and Arturo heckled me a little bit, and I was like, "You little bastard!" And we, you know, started screaming and trash talking, and then we jump in the pool, and the crowd goes crazy. But what happened was Arturo's arms weren't long enough to hold his face out of the cornstarch. I didn't know this when we jumped in. So we are jumping around, rolling around nude in cornstarch. And I decide it'll be funny if I just push him down into the cornstarch. So I push him down to the cornstarch, and I declare victory. Now, what I don't know is he can't pull himself out of the cornstarch.
Oh, shit.
And he can't push his arms down to push off the bottom, and he also can't breathe. So he's down there for just a little bit too long, and then I go, and I'm in the position of, you know,
just like a little chicken
to
tender.
Pull a little person out of cornstarch who can't breathe.
What a rough go Arturo is at your parties.
Well, that's just two of them. The one where I hired a guy to nail his cock to a board and pull a topless stripper across the stage, Arturo just enjoyed that. He was just a spectator. And Extreme Elvis pissing on the crowd, Arturo had the catbird seat. He didn't have urine on him. He had a fine time.
All right,
so some of the parties have gone very well
unscathed.
For Arturo.
Yeah.
But when I pulled him out, what really broke my heart is that Arturo said to me, you know, you saved my life. I couldn't have. And I said, well, yes, but after I'd pushed you,
after I'd murdered starch you.
And held you down. But he was very grateful that I didn't just let him. Now, I want to see what that forensics report from the police officer would have been. Yeah. You know, Penja, we always knew. We always knew there was something not quite right about Penn. Yeah. And sure enough, he drowned a naked little person in cornstarch in his backyard while his sick friends cheered.
Yeah. I can explain. Actually, I guess I can't. Yeah. This is pretty much exactly what happened.
Famous last words, too. Also, I can explain.
The many ways that I've gotten in trouble, I've always wondered how my friends would react. Like, I have my garage has my bedroom right above it. And I had...
So you could be like the Fonz.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I had a Bronco. I had a Bronco automobile that was painted pink and said Pink Death on the side of it. And my plate said Atheist. And I pulled in. I was on the phone talking to somebody. And I guess it was an interesting conversation because I got out of the car and... continued the conversation and left the car running in the garage. Shit. Then I closed the garage door.
Oh boy.
And I went upstairs, finished my conversation, and went to bed. So I had a full tank Bronco running in my garage all night. And I woke up at like 5 a.m. coughing. And my nose filled up and unable to breathe. And I said to myself, boy, the bedroom sure seems smoky. And I went out and I pissed and I took a drink of water and blew my nose, which was black and sooty, and then went back to bed. Because that's the kind of guy I am. Well, I guess I'm just getting a cold or something.
Yeah, you've never slept better.
And I slept very soundly and then woke up groggy and sick and feeling awful. I'm like, oh,
wow.
Coming out with the flu. This is horrible. I kind of, and I get out and I open the door to outside and all of a sudden I'm feeling a lot better. And there's smoke pouring out of my bedroom. And I go, man, this is weird. So I go, wait a minute. That smells like exhaust. And I go downstairs, and the door to the garage is so hot I can't touch it. And I have to get towels. When I open the door, all this smoke comes out, and I have to get towels to touch the car to be able to reach in and turn it off. It's been going for, you know, whatever it was.
Literally Pink Death.
10 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm coughing and miserable. But that's not the important part of the story. None of that matters. What matters is... my friends, if that had happened, I'd stayed in bed another few hours. Although I've been told that the ventilation was good enough that I would never die. But let's just say I could have died in that situation. Then we have my friends talking. And there would be two schools of thought on this. One, Penn was suicidal, we didn't know it, and decided to kill himself by going to bed with the exhaust in. The other is, Penn loved life, but was so stupid. He went to bed with
which
his
one
car
would you
running.
Rather have people remember?
And I've talked to friends of mine, and I said, which camp would you be in? And most of them have said, well, we've never seen you that depressed, but we have seen you stupid. So I wonder, you know, if you were doing the newscast, and one of the things pops up, and it says, you know, you're doing a little thing, Penn Jillette found dead in his house, the car was running, and he died of carbon dioxide poisoning, and then you're going to have a little discussion here. Where do you go? Where do you go with it?
I can't believe he was that bummed out.
You go with the bummed out. Yeah.
Atheist killed by devil-possessed car.
You going with stupid?
I'm going with accident.
Okay.
I'm going with Maximum Overdrive or Christine.
There you go.
The car.
That's what I was gonna say. So everyone's gonna be like, he said he didn't believe in it. Now the
you know
Lord.
What? You know why? Because if you really wanted to kill yourself, you would have been in the car in the garage.
No, not, except it's so much more comfortable in bed. Exactly.
I guess that's true.
Exactly.
You wanted to be surrounded by.
I know how to kill myself. Believe me.
I want to die in a hammock. I just want to die in a hammock.
Is that it?
he died the way he wanted to live. In his bed sniffing exhaust.
Well, we're pretty much at the end of our hour with you, but there's a couple things that I want to cover before we release you into the wild. Number one, I didn't even get to talk to you about juggling, and in college
you a juggler?
Yes, but I'm
why
no good
anymore. Why are we passing clubs?
I don't know. I can do that. I was taught to juggle by Peter Scolari.
Oh, sure.
Who, yeah.
I know Peter.
When I was in college, I worked at a country club he belonged to, and he got me into juggling, and what put me off juggling was that I could never maintain five. I could always get the first little flourish, and then it just went away.
Well, five is hard. And the other thing that's bothersome now is that because of the internet, jugglers have gotten so much better.
Yeah.
And that's something, you know, unintended consequences. I can't believe that because of the internet, and not because they learn how to do it, but because they know it's possible.
Right.
You've got 13-year-olds passing, you know, 12 clubs.
Right.
You know,
seven balls.
Yeah. Just, and if you look at Jason Garfield and the his World Juggling Championships and stuff,
mm-hmm.
you've now got. I was a very good juggler in the 70s, and now even at my peak, I wouldn't even be considered a piker for amateurs.
I went to juggling conventions when I was in college, and one guy that I was always, and this is going to be a very obvious statement if you're a juggler, but if anyone listening can find Michael Motion videos, M-O-S-C-H-E-N.
But you know about Michael Motion.
What?
Do you know who taught him to juggle?
No.
Me.
What?
Do you know where Michael Motion lived?
No.
Next to Michael Collins.
it's better than that. I grew up at 48 Place Terrace, Greenfield, Massachusetts, 01301. That's where I grew up. Greenfield, Massachusetts, 48 Place Terrace. Mike Motion grew up at 38 Place Terrace,
oh my God.
Greenfield, Massachusetts, 01301.
This is amazing.
So, I grew up in Lowell.
Shut the fuck
Lowell?
Up. We're not talking.
Yeah. You're from Lowell?
Yeah, from Lowell.
Yeah, Kerouac.
All right, keep talking again.
Kerouac.
Kerouac is good.
You know
Greenfield.
I know Greenfield. Yeah,
you know
where Greenfield is. Yeah,
I know Lowell. Well, Lowell and Greenfield, we're the same guy. We know all the same stuff.
Holy We've shit. Seen crack.
Yeah. So when I was 12 years old, I desperately wanted to be in show business. Had never met anybody in show business. Didn't think it was possible. So one of the things I did was I learned to juggle. And Colin Motion, who was Mike Motion's older brother by year, and I got a book by Ken Benj from the library on how to juggle.
Wow.
And we learned to juggle with no help, you know, just from a book, learned to do a shower before we did a cascade. But we had lots of time to practice. We were in Greenfield, Massachusetts. And then the week after we started, Mike Motion joined in. And Mike Motion and I started juggling more and more and more and more. And all through high school, our group, the Toss-Ups, was Colin Motion, Mike Motion, and Penn Jillette. And our opening joke was, hi, we're the Toss-Ups. We used to be called the Throw-Ups, but we didn't get as much work. And we would juggle and pass. And then I got out of high school, did not graduate, but plea bargain, got out.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey, the greatest show on earth, Clown College. Then I got out in that and moved to New York and teamed up with Mike Motion, and we did a two-person juggling act. We were the first to pass 9 clubs.
Holy shit.
We were really stupid good. And then we got a job at Great Adventure.
It all comes back around!
Where Mike Motion was standing watching the 300 game be ruined by his juggling partner.
No fucking way.
But it goes further than that.
This is like an Arrested Development episode.
I saw Arturo and the chimpanzee show up.
Well, it turned out that I met Teller, you know, and I was talking to Teller, and I wanted to team up with Teller, but we still had this big place in Jersey. So Mike Motion lived in a house with me and Teller.
Oh,
and
my God.
And he would
God.
Be practicing all the time, working on his solo act while I was working with Teller, and we'd still pass clubs all the time. And I went to Canal Street in New York City, and I was looking for anything that could put together a routine. Yeah. I wanted to do some juggling in the Asparagus Valley Cultural Society. I was already doing two juggling things, doing a ball act and a knife act. I wanted one more thing. So I went to Canal Street, and they had these clear crystal balls.
Yes.
Well, let me finish. A little bigger than softballs.
So excited.
And I bought these crystal balls. I bought 5 of them. And I brought them back to our house. And I sat with Teller and I sat by myself and I juggled these 3, 4, 5 balls in every combination I could, trying to find, because the crystal balls were beautiful. And they didn't look unbreakable. They looked powerful and nice. So I worked and worked and worked. And I was looking in the mirror and I was talking to Teller. I could not find a bit to go with those crystal balls. So they were there on the floor, these acrylic crystal balls.
Oh my God.
And Mike Motion comes to me and says, because we would always go into the Museum of Television History, which you don't, you know, you needed before the internet, and watch these kinescopes of variety acts. So Michael had watched this person that did some one ball manipulation. So Michael said to me, I'm thinking about monkeying with one ball. And I said, oh, that's good juggling because it's one less than you have hands. That'll kill. And they'll be able to focus on it. And Michael came to me and said, you know, could I take those crystal acrylic balls you bought and see if I can do a routine with those?
Oh my
and I said,
God.
I got nothing, man. Go ahead. And then 8 months later, Michael came to us with his one-ball juggling routine with the crystal balls that then went up to two and what is now called contact juggling, but at that time was called Mike Motion's fucking act because everybody stole it. And Mike Motion went on to become a genius MacArthur Grant juggler, and I went on to be in Penn and Teller. But from the time we were 5 years old, we were best friends. I mean, Mike Motion, Colin Motion, and Penn Jillette were the three Motion brothers. You know, we all went everywhere together.
So you've heard of them.
And yes, I was the first one to see his triangle routine.
Oh my God.
I was the first one to see the sticks thing.
Did he get to meet David Bowie in Labyrinth?
I did. He got to be his hands.
He was the hands.
Yeah, yeah. He's hands
for him. And he also did the thing. He also did this thing in like a. I don't know what it was called, but it looked like if you sectioned out a pipe, a big pipe, and he would take balls and just in the middle of it, just bounce balls all around this circle. Yeah. But anyway, I'm so sorry that I didn't know that. That connection is amazing.
And
I bow to you.
If Mike Motion ever sits in this seat and you ask him that question, Mike Motion will say, Colin and I learned to juggle, then a week later we brought panic. He will also tell you, Penn and I went to Canal Street together, and we bought the balls and brought them back. We were both working on routines simultaneously, and Penn couldn't come up with anything, and I came up with something that changed juggling in the 20th century.
Yes.
Pretty much complete agreement. It has, at its core, Penn failed, Mike succeeded. But there are small details that are slightly different.
Well, you have let's just quickly plug the stuff that you have coming. Sure. You have your book that's out.
The book of 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. God No, Signs You May Already Be an Atheist and Other Magical Tales. And the little person and the monkey are not in there, but the extreme Elvis, the whole atheist baptism with a urinating fat Elvis, and me, Ron Jeremy, and Extreme Elvis lined up, because Extreme Elvis has one of the smallest penises in the world. And of course Ron Jeremy, we all know, and I stood between them, and we took a picture, which I like to call Trojans. We fit all men. And
like,
I also
like a seal pipe.
We have a show.
The Discovery
coming out
show,
on the Disco Channel,
yep.
Which I'm trying to call Disco Channel.
I support this.
The Discovery Channel, right after everybody's favorites, the Mythbusters, who are opening for us.
Yep.
And on Wednesday night at 9 o'clock, you can watch the Mythbusters on the Disco Channel. And at 10 o'clock, you can watch Penn and Teller Tell a Lie, which is the same first three words as Penn and Teller Bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
We will give you 7 unbelievable science stories, and one of them is a big obese lie. And you watch it home with your little apps and your computers and try to see if you can vote for when Penn and Teller are lying and when we're telling you the truth about your universe.
Well, I appreciate that. Okay. And I wish you the best of luck with the show and the book. And also just to tell you that that you guys were very influential to me as a comic in the 80s. I mean, I did have an appreciation of illusion and magic, but I was much more of a comedy nerd.
Mm-hmm.
And guys like you, and then also when I was growing up, I loved Amazing Jonathan. Like just watching the guys who were truly able to pull comedy in a way that spoke to me and you know, revealed this world to me. So I thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And you know, all this has really taught me is that I really, really should get together another party. And y'all should be invited.
I think that's
we'll bring Mike Collins out.
I will drive
Holy
out there
shit.
For that. I'll have Vegas for that.
Well, thank you so much, Penn Jillette. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. And thanks for listening.
Yeah.
That's the end. The end of the show.
Oh.
But wait, it's not the end of the show. As sort of promised, a song poem. I tracked one down and
Song poems are amazing. I don't know how this skated under my radar for so long, but clearly I've been an idiot who was asleep and has only just woken up to life thanks to song poems. So here we go. This one is by... Oh, wait, should I do this like radio style? Hey, it's Chris Hardwick on KNRD ISP. And this song is by Norman Burns, and it's called Blue Adams. Now, I'm doing a funny voice, but I actually really like this song a lot. Song poem time. Song poems. Song poems. S poems. Song piece. S piece. S piece? Yes, please.
Love, you've gone and wrecked me through and through. You've got me to the place I don't know what to do. I love you truly. Didn't care. Now all I see is Blue Adams everywhere. Blue Adams whirling about my head. Blue Adams filling my soul. Adams, meet me everywhere. How you haunt me, flying about in the air. Blue Adams, casting your spell over me. Adam, I close my eyes not to see, but there you are, wrecking my soul. It seems that now I have no goal. Blue Adams, whispering in my ear, love is gone. There's nobody now to care. There's nobody now to care.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Stay connected with GoToMyPC, the missing link that turns your iPad into your computer. Download the free app and visit GoToMyPC.com for your free 30-day trial and enter the promo code NERDIST.